The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Hello, this is Katie Neuhauser for the North Carolina Reading Service, and this is Religion in the News. For the next half hour, I will be reading to you from the Religious News Service. Our first article today is entitled, Lawns Light Up for Ramadan as Muslim Families Give Holy Month the Christmas Treatment. Every Christmas season, as her neighbors drape their house and grounds with festive lights, Jasmina Husick's children ask the same question. Mama and Baba, why don't we decorate for Christmas? She said. The mother of five, who lives in Kennesaw, Georgia, would explain that they can appreciate Christmas, but that it's not a Muslim holiday. That didn't seem to satisfy their curiosity. So a couple of years ago, during Ramadan, she tried something different. Husick bought crescent string lights and inflatables to decorate her yard with her kids. And they were so excited, said Husick. Now they realize, oh, it's Ramadan, because we have inflatables and our house has decorations everywhere. It helps them to be proud that they are different. Big box retailers such as Target and Party City have been embracing Ramadan in recent years with indoor holiday supplies from wall decorations to children's books. Many Muslim Americans have enthusiastically embraced the store's nod to representation in return. But for a growing number of small retailers and their Muslim customers, the celebration no longer stops at the front door. Outdoor displays that rival those that appear at Halloween or Christmas are now lighting up lawns during the Islamic Holy Month, which this year began on February 17th in the United States. Since launching her Muslim-oriented inflatables business in 2020, Basharat Rahman has seen sales increase for her displays for Ramadan and Eid, the holiday marking the end of the month of fasting. Her New Traditions store, based in Toronto, is one of several businesses in North America that sells inflatables worldwide in the shapes of mosques, a crescent, and people holding up a Ramadan Mubarak banner. There were a lot of parents out there that felt the same sort of void that we did, said Rahman. The concept is not without its critics, who say Muslims should not mimic non-Islamic holidays. But Rahman said those commentators likely don't understand the challenges of raising Muslim children in a world where Christians can overshadow the delights of other faiths. If we just tell our children Ramadan is just about praying and fasting, a child will not find that appealing, she said. You have to introduce it in a fun way in the beginning years so that by the time they're older, they can actually partake in the spiritual aspects of Ramadan. Some mosques across the country have also opted to hang lights or signs to mark the month when Muslims fast from dawn to sunset. Professional Christmas decorating companies have caught wind of the trend and are extending their season beyond December. Several lighting companies in Michigan, New Jersey, and Illinois advertised services ahead of Ramadan this year. In Livonia, Michigan, close to Detroit's western suburbs and their densely Muslim neighborhoods, Martin Zoros, owner of Zoros Lights, said the more than 20 homes he has decorated for Ramadan so far is down from previous years due to what he suspects are lean financial times. But Nora Farhat, a Muslim who runs the Detroit area company Wonderly Lights, said Muslim clients make up a larger chunk of her business this year at about 10%. It's ironic. We are a proud Christmas lighting company, but actually, we are proud Muslims doing holiday lights, she said. Farhat said interest in outdoor displays from both Muslim and non-Muslim families took off during the COVID-19 lockdowns as outdoor lights, she said, offered joy to people spending holidays apart from their families. In 2020, in the middle of the pandemic, Halal Metropolis, an organization in Dearborn, devised a Ramadan home lights competition as a way to maintain the Ramadan spirit during a time of isolation, according to organizers. Since then, Farhat said more Muslim families have sought her services for string lights and displays, such as crescent-shaped wreaths in traditional Ramadan green. The same way a neighbor might decorate for Christmas, the neighbor next door is decorating for Ramadan. There is a really beautiful unity to it, because we're all doing it, just with our unique touches, she said. And when people are able to share their different beliefs and customs, I think it brings more beauty, and the lighting concept is a beautiful way to do that. The city of Dearborn, where the large Muslim population has sometimes been a flashpoint, has decorated its streetlights with the crescent moons and stars for Ramadan. The display, commissioned by the city's development authority, is the first of its kind in Dearborn, a spokesperson said. This initiative reflects who we are as a city, said Mayor Abdullah H. Hamoud in a statement. Each season we stand side by side to celebrate all of the traditions that make us special. It's no wonder we continue to set new standards for holiday and cultural displays. Light Up Columbus, an Ohio company, created Dearborn's custom Christmas and Ramadan displays. Since then, owner Chris Affelstadt said mosques and a school have expressed interest in his work, which he said shows the importance of having holidays represented in a public way. Being on display is a big deal, and it brings people joy, Affelstadt said. When we can bring people joy with lighting, we want to do that. And it doesn't matter to us what the religion is, what the reason is. But for Muslims, the reason comes down to community. Rhonda Restrom, mother of two, said public recognition of Ramadan in Dearborn streets and schools has made it easier for her young children to practice some aspects of the holy month. It's really important for them to just be proud of their culture and their religion, said Restrom, who paid Wonderly Lights to light up her Dearborn home this year. I just want my kids to remember that it's a special time. Husick, the Georgia mother, said it's also important that her displays spark conversations with curious neighbors who want to learn about her beliefs. It just makes it even more special that my neighbors appreciate it, she said. And this ends this article. The second article for today's podcast is entitled Minnesota Faith Groups Sue DHS Over Access to Immigrant Detainees. A group of religious organizations and faith leaders in Minnesota has filed a lawsuit against the Department of Homeland Security, alleging the agency is violating their religious freedom by denying them access to immigrant detainees at a local federal building. The lawsuit was filed Monday, February 23rd, by the Minneapolis Area Synod of the Evangelical Lutheran Church in America, the Minnesota Conference of the United Church of Christ, and the Reverend Christopher Collins, a Jesuit priest. It alleges the government's refusal to allow faith leaders access to the Bishop Henry Whipple Federal Building, which houses the local offices of the U.S. Immigration and Customs Enforcement, is a violation of their rights under the First Amendment and the Religious Freedom Restoration Act. Pastoral care is the heart and soul of what our pastors and deacons are called to provide in their congregations and around the community. We walk together, listening, praying, guiding, and offering the peace and presence of Jesus Christ, Bishop Jen Nagel of the ELCA's Minneapolis Area Synod said in a statement. This is particularly important during times of stress, grief, isolation, and transition. Clergy have been denied access to Whipple as recently as Monday morning, according to Arana Vierman, CEO of Groundwork Legal, one of the law firms representing the plaintiffs, along with the firm Saul Ewing. Faith leaders and clergy across the state have been attempting to access the Whipple building since the beginning of Operation Metro Surge, Vierman said in an interview, referring to the immigration enforcement campaign that began in Minneapolis in December. Clergy, she added, were even denied access on Ash Wednesday, a Christian holy day. there was permanent damage done when they were not able to provide that care on Ash Wednesday. But the need and desire to provide the care and receive the care extends beyond even one of the holiest days of those in the Christian faith, she said. The lawsuit alleges that preventing clergy from entering the facility to offer pastoral care to migrants infringes on their religious freedom. By categorically barring faith leaders from praying with detainees, offering sacraments, or providing spiritual guidance, the government imposes a profound and unjustified burden, the complaint reads. The ability to provide pastoral care ensures that even in the most dire legal processes that could result in deportation or prolonged detention, individuals are treated with dignity and humanity, not as mere inventory. DHS did not immediately respond to a request for comment on the lawsuit, but the complaint alleges agency officials told Bishop Nagel that Whipple is a processing facility, not a detention facility, and that no one is allowed access to provide pastoral care, purportedly for safety reasons. The agency made a similar argument last year to justify barring faith leaders from entering an ICE facility in Illinois. Vaynerman alleged that the Whipple building is not simply a processing center, but a place where detainees have been held for hours and sometimes days. A Religion News Service reporter was present last month when the Reverend Susie Hayward, a UCC minister, and two other UCC pastors entered the Whipple building and attempted to minister to detainees. While the trio was allowed to into the building, they were denied access to the detainees, with the group eventually praying in the building's foyer before leaving. The trio was told by an official at the building that they should call a number to arrange a visit to the detainees, but Vaynerman said faith leaders have tried that and hit a brick wall. When clergy finally were able to reach someone on that number, they were again categorically barred from providing pastoral care, she said. Ultimately, upon speaking with someone, they were told, "No, you cannot come in." Hayward, who has been active in faith-based pushback to Trump's mass deportation efforts in Minneapolis, celebrated the new lawsuit. "Pastoral care is not optional for us," she said in a statement. "It's a sacred duty. Blocking clergy from ministering to people in detention violates their rights and ours. It reveals a contradiction between the government's rhetoric and its actions." Hayward added, "Religious freedom cannot be selectively applied. It must protect both those detained and those called to care for them." The faith leaders' lawsuit is similar to a separate ongoing legal battle in Illinois, where a group of Catholic priests, nuns, and organization leaders filed suit last year, insisting they be granted access to detainees at an ICE facility in Broadview, just outside of Chicago. The government's refusal to allow the faith leaders to enter the facility, which plaintiffs allege is a shift from years past, sparked a series of protests at the site that resulted in the arrest of at least 8 faith leaders from a range of religious traditions. Faith-based pushback to Trump's mass deportation efforts in general has been far-reaching, with religious leaders in Minnesota in particular staging major protests and training hundreds of clergy from across the country on how to resist ICE. The issue of access for faith leaders to detainees reached all the way to the Vatican. Pope Leo spoke out on the topic in November, saying, "I would certainly invite the authorities to allow pastoral workers to attend to the needs of those people." What's more, Catholic bishops, including at least 2 associated with Trump's own Religious Liberty Commission, have voiced concern about the denial of access. Last week, a federal judge issued an order requiring the federal government to coordinate with the Coalition for Spiritual and Public Leadership, a Chicago area Catholic advocacy organization and one of the plaintiffs in the case. to allow the clergy to access the site on Ash Wednesday. The government ultimately granted two Catholic priests and a nun access to the facility, but for reasons that remain unclear, they initially found the building empty. After an hour wait, a small group of detainees were brought to the facility where they met with the faith leaders. In an interview, the Reverend Leandro Fossa, who was part of the delegation allowed into the facility, described an emotional meeting with the detainees, young men and women just past their teens. "We saw their tears, confusion. For them, their dreams were just about to end. They had to start all over, so you could see the anxiety on their faces. The battle is lost," he said. But Fusa, who has long worked in prison ministries, said that as he and others offered the group communion and rubbed ashes on their foreheads, the value of their ministry was made clear. "Our presence, our words, our journeying with them, it was a moment where they could feel that they were not alone," he said. "The community is with them. God walks with them." Fusa said he and others discussed with officials in the building the possibility of a weekly or even daily delegation at the facility, but a formal agreement has yet to materialize, and the lawsuit is ongoing. "We have to follow our gospel. I was in prison and you visited me. I was naked and you clothed me," he said. "We cannot choose to love someone only when that person has papers. We love. Love doesn't choose." And this ends this article. Our next article for this day is entitled, "Two New D.C. Congregations Cater to Black Jews." With two new congregations led by and for African American and Caribbean Jews, Washington, D.C. is emerging as a center of Black Jewish life in the United States. Ohel Edot Chamdat, which means Tent of the Precious Congregations, or OEC for short, will hold its first Shabbat evening service in a rented building on the DuPont Circle neighborhood of Washington, D.C. on March 20th. The group's founder, Rabbi Shays Rishon, will lead the service. "Every other Jewish ethnicity or culture gets to have its own space," Rishon, a prolific writer and speaker who is best known in the Jewish world by his pen name Mat Nishtana, said in an interview. "You have Ashkenazi shuls, which is synagogues, Sephardi, Persian, Syrian, Russian, Bulgarian, Egyptian, Moroccan. It's about time we stop being guests in other people's houses." OEC is the second Black-led Jewish congregation to launch in D.C. in the past 6 months. Kehillat Sankofa held high holiday services last fall at a private D.C. home. Rabbi Coach Baruch Fraser formed the community in part because he had trouble finding a pulpit position after graduating from the Reconstructionist Rabbinical College in 2024. "There didn't seem to be a place that could accept me as a leader," said Fraser, who is trans and the founder of the Black Trans Torah Club. At the same time, Fraser was hearing from other Black Jews in the Washington area that they longed for a congregation that puts them at the center, as opposed to one that just says, "You're welcome to come here." The two new startups are part of an ongoing American Jewish tradition of prayer circles and fellowship groups formed to meet the needs of particular affinity groups, be they LGBTQ+ groups or anti-Zionists. A 2020 Pew Research Center survey suggested 1% of U.S. Jewish adults are Black. Other sources, including the Berkeley-based Jews of Color Initiative, suggest at least 12 to 15%, or over 1 million U.S. residents, are Jews of color. Jews of color continue to face barriers to full inclusion at the Jewish community. 54% of them have experienced racial discrimination in congregational settings, according to a 2021 survey by the Jews of Color Initiative. Black Jews in particular have reported feeling more marginalized since October 7, 2023, when the Israel-Hamas war started. While Kehillat, Sankofa, and OEC cater to Black Jews, the congregations are distinct in ways that reflect the backgrounds of their founders. Rishon, 44, grew up in Brooklyn and was ordained by the Chabad Lubavitch movement. OEC will be modern Orthodox in style, with separate seating for men and women and kosher food. Shabbat services will reflect a blend of influences. There will also be things that are unique to African American Jews, Rishon said, such as singing of a Hebrew version of Lift Every Voice and Sing, often referred to as the Black National Anthem. Fraser, 48, grew up in an African Methodist Episcopal home in Kansas City, Missouri, but said he has Jewish roots in Africa. He described Kehillat Sankofa as interdenominational with mixed seating and a major musical component. Fraser plays the djembe, a West African drum, and uses original liturgical melodies that he and other Black Jews have written. Kehillah means community in Hebrew, and Sankofa is an Akan word meaning go back and get. Kehillat Sankofa's logo includes the Sankofa bird symbol, which represents learning from the past to move forward. He stressed that OEC and Kehillat Sankofa are not in competition with each other. We know sometimes people's practices change over time, so I'm glad there'll be multiple places for folks to go, he said. There are a number of synagogues with majority Black memberships in the United States, including Beth Shalom, B'nai Zaken, Ethiopian Hebrew congregations in Chicago, Congregational Temple Bethel in Philadelphia, and Beth Shalom Hebrew Congregation in Brooklyn. Many of these communities have roots in the Hebrew-Israelite spiritual movement, which arose in the 19th century American South. Rishon and Fraser differ in their attitudes toward Hebrew Israelites, Black Americans, and other people of color who claim descent from the 12 tribes of Israel. Rishon does not consider them to be part of a mainstream Judaism because, as he writes on the OEC website, they do not meet the established criteria such as matrilineal or patrilineal descent or formal conversion that are used to identify someone as Jewish. Fraser, on the other hand, welcomes all people who identify as Jews, Israelites, or Hebrews to participate in the Kehillat Sankofa events. We're not making distinctions because we believe that we are all family, he said. We don't all have to agree about Jewish law or how we say the prayers, but what we can agree about is our belief in Yah, which is God. Both rabbis said their communities would be open to non-Black Jews, too. Kehillat Sankofa and OEC represent new sorts of Jewish beginnings at a time when long-established synagogues are closing across the country, said Alana Cooper, a religious studies professor at Case Western Reserve University. The number of synagogues in the U.S. has declined by about 20% since 1990, Cooper's research reveals. Institutional arrangements have simply run their course, with younger generations looking to fulfill their religious and spiritual needs in new ways, explained Cooper, the author of the forthcoming book, Disposing of the Sacred, American Jewish Congregations in the 21st Century. Since announcing the launch of OEC earlier this month, Rishon has raised more than $3,000 through a GoFundMe campaign. He is looking to acquire prayer books and ritual objects, rent a Torah scroll, and pay for two security guards, among other expenses. Over the past few years, some Black Jews have raised concerns about racial profiling by guards at majority white synagogues. Rishon said the dynamic at OEC will be fundamentally different because Black Jews will be the norm, not the exception. At first, the congregation will host once a month Shabbat services along with holiday gatherings. Rishon, who earlier this month was featured on the PBS series Black and Jewish America, an interwoven history, also plans to offer online Jewish literacy classes. Kehillat Sankofa is being built slowly as Fraser juggles other freelance jobs. The next event will be a Passover cookout in the spring. Fraser expects Black Jews from around the country to travel to D.C. for the celebration, which will include the roasting of a lamb in commemoration of the Passover service. Daitra Reiser attended Kehillat Sankofa's Rosh Hashanah services with her ex-husband and their two teenage daughters. Fraser co-led the services with Shoshana Akua Brown, an educator and Kohenet, or Hebrew priestess. "It was really good to be in a multicultural, Black-affirming space," said Reiser, who lives in D.C. and sits on the JOCI board. She added that the service was very different from what her mixed-race daughters were accustomed to. They grew up in a very traditional, predominantly white, Ashkenazi Reform synagogue, she said. "I'm excited for my kids to have this space and look forward to seeing what we can build." And this ends this article. With very short amount of time left, I'm going to begin an article, but I won't be able to finish it. It's entitled, "Supporters of Jailed Ugandan Opposition Figure Pray for Him After President Tries to Stop It." I'll do the best I can with pronouncing some of these names. In Kampala, Uganda, hundreds of supporters of detained Ugandan opposition figure Kizza Besigye held a defiant prayer service inside a Catholic cathedral on Monday to press authorities to free him after more than a year without trial on treason charges, saying he is in failing health. The Archbishop of Kampala, Paul Sesmugeri, had been expected to preside, but attendees were told the event had been postponed. The Chancellor of the Archdiocese, Pius Male, told the Associated Press the Archbishop sought a postponement because there were issues which were still being discussed so that many have harmony. He gave no details. Instead of heading out, those inside Lubaga Cathedral sang hymns and prayed, led by Winnie Bayanima, the UNAIDS director who married Besigye in the church years ago. The event was the first of its kind in support of Besigye, who has sometimes appeared in court in a wheelchair. He has been repeatedly denied bail, even as many Ugandans urge compassion. His trial is yet to formally start. Besigye told the crowd that the Archbishop had informed her of President Yoweri's request to postpone the event pending an investigation into whether it was political. And we have run out of time for today's episode of Religion in the News. We hope you enjoyed listening. Please join us next time. I'm Katie Neuhauser, reading for the North Carolina Reading Service. The content of this program is intended for people who are blind or print impaired. Religion in the News is available as a podcast at our website, ncreadingservice.org. If you have any comments or questions, please call 919-832-5138. That number again is 919-832-5138. Thank you for listening to the North Carolina Reading Service.